Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of It's Crime Time. I know this case has been very popular, and I've seen mention of her name literally everywhere lately, but I knew absolutely zero about her case, who she was, and I'm not sure why I exactly chose not to look into this case sooner, considering it's been everywhere, and I thought maybe there was something interesting about it, considering it was literally all over the news. It was everywhere, you know, online. But I just never read about it. I never looked into it. And I did finally read some articles and really went down a rabbit hole with this case. And this is probably one of the more gruesome crimes upon a single victim in the 2020s so far, at least that I've heard about. And I'm talking about the case of Taylor Chabusiness and Shad Therian. All right, everyone, it's crime time. Before I continue this episode, I would like to place a disclaimer here that this episode does make mention of sexual assault on a minor and various other graphic sexual details. And if that is something that you feel you cannot handle, please feel free to click away. Taylor Denise Coronado was born on November 23, 1997 in Chicago, Illinois, to parents Marla and Arturo Coronado. She has a brother, Arturo Jr., who they say goes by AJ. When Taylor was in fourth grade, the family moved to Wisconsin. And then in May of 2009, Taylor's mother, Marla, had passed away due to chronic cirrhosis of the liver. Her mother was an alcoholic and she struggled with some dependency issues. And of course, that led to her having cirrhosis of the liver and ultimately it took her life. So this was a rough time for Taylor in life. And before I continue, I should not have to explain myself, but I'm not sympathizing with her in the fact that obviously she killed someone. And I'm not saying that that's a valid reason, you know, that she had a rough start in life and, you know, her mother passed away and all this, but she was young and everyone deals with things differently. And she did not deal with it well. And it kind of helped to shape her. Now her choices are her own and she made her own choices. We all go through hardships in life. And of course, I'm not a, you know, murderer, you know, and neither are you, I hope. No, but seriously. So not all of us who have dealt with hardships obviously go out and kill people, but that's kind of, I think, the start of things when it comes to turning her into the type of person she was. So this was devastating for her because she was close with her mother, and I'm not really sure what effect her mother's actual alcoholism had on her as a child, but I can't imagine it was a very good one. But nonetheless, she was very close with her mother, and this was a devastating time, and she started acting out at this time. And Arturo, her father, then married again just 1 year after Marla's death, and this new wife of his also had children of her own. And Taylor just found it difficult to kind of fit into the family anymore due to, you know, grieving her mother and then not even having much time to grieve her mother really before her father had already moved on. And I'm not saying that someone shouldn't move on, I'm not judging there. It's just, it took him a year and she was young. And so it became difficult for her and she started acting out and her father kind of tried everything he could. He did find at one point her attempting suicide and he attempted to get help for her and everything, but none of this worked. So she eventually moved in with her paternal grandparents in Texas, primarily because of what I had mentioned about her feeling like she really didn't fit into the family now that her mother had passed and her father had remarried. And as a teenager, Taylor engaged in drug use such as heroin and methamphetamines, which I mean, she did witness her mom, you know, struggle with addiction. And sometimes I guess that's a family thing. It's a genetic thing. A lot of families have that issue. but she kind of just took up drug use. And in 2018, her father was handed a 12-year prison sentence for sexually assaulting, raping a minor under 16 years old. So apparently a 13-year-old girl had come forward and said that Arturo had went into her bedroom with her and he raped her in her bedroom. So he was also given 18 years of supervision after he would be released from doing the 12 years in prison. So at this point, Arturo's second wife leaves him due to the allegations and then ultimately charges against him. And I obviously don't blame her there. So his second wife left and he was in prison and Taylor was living with her grandparents at this time. On February 14th of 2020, Taylor marries a man named Warren Chabot. Chabot was actually his legal last name, and it somehow became Chabusiness on his Facebook. And then Taylor Coronado legally changes her name to Taylor Chabusiness instead of Chabot, which, by the way, very weird choice of last name. I have no idea what made them change it to Chabusiness. I think it was honestly something funny. Something I really literally feel like it was to be funny. Like, because Warren and Taylor, they had their own small businesses going on Facebook. They were young entrepreneurs. And Taylor often posted on the internet about making beadwork items. She made necklaces, dog tags, bracelets. And she sold them on their Facebook. So they had small businesses. And I have no idea. I'm just taking a wild guess. The show business was to be funny. I have no idea. So I thought that was really weird. And then the June following her marriage, Taylor is arrested when a man calls emergency services to report her acting strangely and to request a welfare check on her because he just feared that she was under the influence of something and she was just acting really weird. So the police arrive outside and they attempt to talk to her, and she asks the police why she has to stop for them and informs them that she just shot up and was on a different planet at that moment. So yeah, she was, I guess, outside acting really erratically, really weird. And someone saw her and they called police, and then police came and they discovered she was definitely on drugs. She was out of it. And she admitted it. She just flat out admitted it. Like, yeah, I just shot up. I'm on a different planet. Then the officer calls for backup and the other officer arrives. And when he does, Taylor is being argumentative with the officers and she starts to walk across the road into oncoming traffic. And one of the officers attempts to grab her to take her to safety and she just begins kicking them. So she's flailing around, kicking at them because they kind of had a hold of her. They were not, you know, about to let her get hit by a car. So she is arrested at this point and she was charged with battery on a member of law enforcement and resisting arrest. Taylor got 3 months probation out of this, which I find odd because I know people that have done a lot less and definitely got prison time, but I'm not sure how Wisconsin works. Legally, of course, that was their choice. I believe this was her first time, you know, with law enforcement or having any kind of encounter with law enforcement on her own behalf where she's doing something bad. And then 2 months after this, so about in August, she gets in trouble again after an officer attempts to pull her over for speeding, and she just takes off and engages them on a high-speed chase. When they manage to apprehend her, they locate a little drug kit in her car. I believe it was in her center console. It had syringes, tourniquets, things for shooting up, other drug paraphernalia, probably meth, smoking equipment, whatever, and the drugs themselves. She was charged with possession of drugs and drug paraphernalia. And apparently they did check the syringes, and the syringe had like some crystals in there, which turned out to actually be methamphetamine. So oddly enough, she was injecting meth. She also got charged with obstructing an officer, not complying with probation guidelines, and fleeing. She was given 3 months in prison and 18 months probation, but her prison time was reduced to only being house arrest. Later in 2020, her husband Warren was arrested with 46 grams of methamphetamine for attempting to distribute. He was given a plea deal and he made a post on Facebook stating that he was locked up on federal charges and that he knew he would be out by 2024. In October of 2021, Taylor gave birth to a baby boy whom she named Mateo Coronado, which is very weird. She gave the baby her last name and not even Shabusiness, which, thank goodness, that's horrendous, but Mateo Coronado, which, okay. And she was very excited to be a mother at this point. The child was her husband Warren's. And CPS actually took Mateo from her 24 hours after she had given birth. And I have not found out, but I do believe that it obviously has to do with her drug use and things of that nature. They probably, you know, when he was born, they probably tested him or witnessed, you know, him withdrawing, something of that nature. And so he was taken immediately. I mean, 24 hours after, but still. Taylor then goes to a shelter and her grandmother is given custody of Mateo. Since Taylor's husband had been sent to prison and she lost custody of her child, it kind of makes sense that she would be seeking, you know, some sort of companionship. And this is where she began seeing Shad Therian. She had known Shad from school and they had kept in contact. And Taylor and Shad began some sort of sexual relationship at this point in time because Shad had been single and Taylor's husband was in prison. I don't know that they actually began a serious dating type of relationship because from what I've gathered, they were just friends or like friends with benefits, something of that nature or whatever, but her husband was in prison. She was seeking comfort in Shad or having another, you know, a man around. So she became close with Shad and they began some sort of relationship. And I believe Shad was 24 at the time, and Taylor was 24 as well at this point. On February 23rd, 2022, police received a phone call at 3:28 a.m. to be dispatched to a home in Green Bay, Wisconsin. This call was from Tara, who was Shad's mother. Tara had located her son Shad's head in a bucket in the basement. Tara's boyfriend can be heard stating that something's in the damn bucket and she's a little freaked out and it's kind of freaking me out. This is what he tells the dispatcher. The dispatcher asks what makes her think that her son's head is in that bucket. And she tells them she saw it. I decided to insert a clip of the 911 call made by Shad's mother after the discovery of his severed head in the bucket. It is particularly hard to hear in some parts, but the initial call was made by her boyfriend, and then you can kind of hear her in the background, and then she talks on it briefly.
Yes, I live in Officer 829 Stony Brook. My friend just woke me up and swears that she found her severed head of her son in the basement.
Okay, can you repeat the address, sir?
829 Stony Brook. Is it EY, right? Yes. No E. Just that one.
Is that a house apartment duplex?
It's a house.
Your phone number?
My number is 327-3748. My name's Steve.
327-3748?
Yes.
What's your last name, Steve?
Anders.
Okay, tell me what's happening there again.
I have no clue what's happening with my girl. Swears that she's found her severed head of her son in the basement.
Did you go down there?
In a bucket. I went down. I can't tell what the fuck is. I just part of my leg is up. Kind of go freaked out.
Okay. Did she just wake up and say that?
Yeah.
And whose head is it?
She's claiming it's her son.
How old is her son?
24, 20, 25. No, yeah, he was here yesterday with some chick, and then now all of a sudden nobody's here, and she came up to use the restroom a couple times, and she keeps calling and calling, and now she's saying that she hears the phone down there, too.
Okay. Is she with you right now?
Yes, she's upstairs. She's a little freaked out, and I don't know what to do.
Okay, all right. you said you went down there, correct?
Yeah, I lifted a towel, but I can't see very well, and I can't tell what the hell it is.
So there's something in the bucket.
There's something in the goddamn bucket. There's something in the goddamn bucket.
Okay.
If she ran broke again, I don't know what the hell.
Do you think she's hallucinating, or do you think that...
I don't think so. I went down there, something in the damn bucket. I don't know, man. She's a little freaked out, and... kind of freaking you.
What's your girlfriend's last name?
Kakanek.
How do you spell that?
Oh, holy shit. You want to spell it?
P-A-K-A-N-I-C-H.
What's your first name?
P-A-R-A.
What's your middle initial for your first?
What's your middle initial?
I just jumped out of my house being so
could be like a fake head or something?
Not just in it. I'm not looking at it again.
Okay. All right, ma'am. Just go ahead and wait for the officers, okay?
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
And it kind of sounds like the dispatcher didn't really believe. And I mean, I understand. I would be in disbelief too. Somebody calls me and says, I just found my son's head in a bucket in the basement at 3:28 in the morning. Very creepy. I could not even imagine. That would be horrendous. It would be terrifying, heartbreaking. I couldn't imagine, you know, what Chad's mother was feeling at this time. She probably was in a very large state of disbelief at first, you know, because she was hearing noises and things of that nature, and she thought she heard a vehicle, I guess, pull into their driveway or something. And, you know, this all was kind of freaking her out, and she decided to go down to the basement and look. And right, I guess, at the bottom of the steps was the bucket, and it had some sort of sheet or blanket or towel over it. And she removes it and looks in, and she sees a head in there, and it is her son's. So I could not even imagine. She kind of woke up at this point because she thought she heard like somebody knock on the door as well. And there was a storm that night, so the door had slammed, and maybe it was from the storm, but she kind of feared that somebody had been there, you know, creeping around or something. So, and this was between 2 and 3 a.m. And then she noticed the basement light was on, so that's when she went to investigate. She heard the vehicle, the loud bang of the door. She went down to the basement, and I don't obviously blame her for going down there. It's her house, and she's going to investigate, and especially a random bucket that showed up at the bottom, you know, of the stairs, and it wasn't there before. So a closer look was taken in the bucket, and in this bucket was Chad's severed head, his severed penis, and two knives. There was a torso and body parts in various bags, as well as a carving knife and a bread knife. A blood-crusted mattress and some drug paraphernalia were also found nearby. Tara had stated that she had not seen her son for 2 days. On February 21st, Taylor picked Chad up at 9:30 p.m. Tara's boyfriend had seen Taylor go into the basement during the early morning hours on February 22nd. This information obviously spurs police to investigate Taylor further, because she could be a possible victim of the crime as well, or she could be implicated as the murderer of Chad, so she could have, you know, Ben's murderer. So either way, police needed to further search the home and then go talk to Taylor. So the police further searched the home to see what other evidence can be found. And meanwhile, they needed to locate Taylor and question her. So they kind of show up at her home and they notice her. They catch her right there exiting her van. It actually wasn't her van. It was her roommate's or something of that nature. But either way, she's getting out of the van. And she's dressed in all black, but the officers still notice that she's covered in blood. So it's dark out, she's wearing black, and they still see the blood on her, so must have been a decent amount. Officers arrest Taylor, and they take her in for questioning, and they do inspect her van. And when they search the van, they locate a crockpot box containing more body parts, including some legs in it behind the driver's seat. This van actually, like I said, belonged to Taylor's roommate, so I couldn't even imagine, you know, her roommate finding out she had brutally murdered Chad and then put body parts in the van. Like, just imagine, you know, your vehicle being taken by the police and, you know, they say, oh, we need to investigate this brutal murder. We found body parts in it. That's crazy. So at the station, they informed Taylor that Chad's head had been located in a bucket at mother's home, and she replies with, quote, that's pretty fucked up, end quote. She explains to them that she blacked out because her and Chad had been smoking marijuana, smoking meth, which she refers to as the bitch, and shooting up trazodone. So I don't understand why. I've never tried it, obviously, but she refers to meth as the bitch. She explains that Chad grabbed two dog choker collars and brought them to the basement. Now, they were into BDSM, which I'm not going to go into too much detail, but it's perfectly fine in consenting circumstances. It's a really large community. It's no big deal. Of course, so he was consenting. They were obviously going to engage in some sexual acts, and he brings the dog collars down. But she explains that when she put the choker on him, she choked him until he died. She says that Chad was kind of laying face down in the bed and she was sitting on his back or something, riding him like a donkey. Very weird. But hey, whatever. That's their thing. And she was choking him with the collar. So she was kind of grabbing onto the back of the collar. She was sitting on his back and she was choking him. And she said she could kind of feel his heart beating, I guess, through his back when she was sitting on him. And for some reason, she just decided she wanted to take his life by continuing to choke him. She was clearly, you know, not in her right mind when explaining this story, because she kind of explains how he could rebuild. So I'm assuming she believed that if she killed him and stopped his heart, that he would rebuild himself and he would come back. She said that his face turned purple and he was coughing up blood, but she kept choking him. She tells him she enjoyed killing him and that even after he was dead, this is very brutal, by the way. After he was dead, she continued the sex acts on him. She performed oral sex on him. She put a dildo in his mouth and in his anus, and she was playing around with his body for 2 to 3 hours, she said. Then, I guess after this whole sex act thing is done, which that's crazy to me, she decides she wants to cut him up using knives from his mother's kitchen. So at this point, she obviously realized, okay, he's not rebuilding. He's not waking up, you know. So I'm not sure if she truly believed this or if it was just, you know, some story she had made up to make herself seem crazy. She was obviously on drugs at the time. If you watch her interrogation, she makes no sense. You can barely understand some of the stuff she says. But I truly don't really believe that she thought he could come back to life. I just don't. But she says she did. And she says she chose a bread knife because it was serrated and it made it easier to dismember his body. She laughs kind of when the police question her and says that she can't believe she got lazy and forgot his head. And you can view her interrogation video and it's quite disturbing, but honestly, this kind of thing's odd to me because what type of person would she have been if she wasn't on drugs? You know what I mean? I always see that and I always hear things that people do when they're on drugs, when they have mental illness, you know. So if she wasn't on drugs, if she'd never touched drugs in her life, would she have ever even killed him? Would she have ever been the type of person she is if she had just gotten help for her mental health and stayed off of, you know, the illegal substances? So I'm not sure. It always just makes me wonder about people that do these sort of crimes that are particularly brutal. Now, there's plenty of people that have committed brutal crimes that weren't on drugs, but when they are, I don't know, it makes me think. So her trial began on February 14th, 2023, which is very weird to me, Valentine's Day, and that's when she actually married her husband, Warren. He was still in prison. But her lawyer, Quinn Jolly, argued that her trial needed to be delayed until at least May so that more people could assess her and the case to see if she was even competent enough to stand trial. And there's a video of her in court, which you can view, that she attacks her lawyer at one point during the trial and she then gets a new lawyer. But she clearly isn't in the right mind if she's attempting to attack the one person who has her back, the one person who's trying to help her, her lawyer. And she just, it's really weird. You can't hear a whole lot. And then she just jumps on him and starts attacking him. Really strange. And then once again, I'm not taking up for her, but there's clearly something wrong with people that do that. There's clearly something wrong with people that kill people in general. I'm not saying all of them need to be, you know, sent to mental institutions instead of prisons and all that, you know, and found not guilty by reason of insanity. But I'm just saying, obviously, if you kill somebody for fun, there is something wrong with you. So, and then she attacks her lawyer and there's clearly something wrong. So on July 13th of 2023, forensic psychologist Diane Litton determined that Taylor was not competent to stand trial. She determined that Taylor had some sort of active psychotic disorder. The first time Diane met Taylor, she threw a chair at her and she refused to talk to her. Diane clearly notices that Taylor's body language doesn't really match situations because she's often seen smiling and smirking during the weirdest of situations. She also says she experiences hallucinations that tell her to hurt people. Another witness psychologist is brought in named Dr. Matthew Steele, who says that Taylor is fit to stand trial. And I'm in no way, like I said, taken up for her, but I don't think that at that point she was right in her right mind enough to stand trial. Just because of the things she was doing, there's clearly something wrong with anyone that does what she does and kind of acts the way she does. But at the same time, I know a lot of murderers have literally acted this way, faking it to try to get out of what they did, you know, to try to plead not guilty by reason of insanity. They have to play the part. There's a lot of people that do that. So, you know, she might have been acting. I mean, we don't know. There, you know, there's a side that says she is, which would be the witness psychologist who says that she's fine. You know, there's, she's fit to stand trial. And then the other psychologist who says, like, there's clearly something wrong with her. She's clearly in some kind of active disorder. And her trial begins on July 24th of 2023. Even though her defense attorney didn't want certain information to be brought to trial, it was brought to trial regardless. Her phone searches in particular included stuff about Satanism, Jeffrey Dahmer's butt, and looking sexy when you appear in court. The fear was that this made her look like she wanted to model after Jeffrey Dahmer and be like him, and that she premeditated this murder. And obviously, her lawyer did not want people to think she premeditated the murder. I don't personally believe it was premeditated, even though she seemed to be fascinated with dark subjects and murder. I mean, if somebody saw my search history to make these podcast episodes, it would look like I am into some really weird stuff too. So, I mean, she probably was already having, you know, fantasies about killing people. She probably was, you know, infatuated with it, thinking about doing it or whatever. But I don't know that this particular time was premeditated. But then again, we're not her, so we can't really say, you know, what she was planning. But they took the drugs and then they engaged in, you know, some sexual acts, and then it happened. So I don't know. I mean, she could have been planning it, you know. She could have been saying, like, hey, the next time we do things, I'm just gonna choke him. I don't know. So very weird situation. And her lawyers did not want the information to get out there, but it was definitely put out there. It was told to them in court, so everyone knew she was researching that kind of stuff. As a teenager, Taylor struggled with her mental health, and she was put on mood stabilizers, antipsychotics, and antidepressants at just 12 years old. She was diagnosed with ADHD or something of that nature due to her having concentration issues in school. She chose to stop taking her medication at the age of 18, and then she was diagnosed with PTSD and bipolar. She tried to take her own life, like Ed mentioned. So she clearly had issues before all of this, as well as dependency issues. And this was brought up in court. On July 26, 2023, the jury begins to hear what exactly happened to Shad. The jury is shown graphic photos. They're played the 911 call made by Shad's mother. Police body cam footage of Taylor's arrest was shown, and her interview with the police. The medical examiner discusses their findings of the body, saying that the body was basically bloodless. The body had been flayed open, and the flesh and muscles of the back were removed to expose his ribcage and his spine. The torso had been cut in half so that she could have access to remove his organs, and oddly enough, one of Shad's feet had been stuffed into his chest cavity. Very weird. Very sickeningly... it's just very disturbing that she would stuff his foot into his chest cavity. And then, of course, her spending 2 to 3 hours playing with his body and then dismembering him kind of allows the prosecution to believe that she was not insane because of her choices to do this versus what state of mind she may have been in had she been having some kind of psychotic break. Because she did make a lot of wild choices after she killed him, you know. I'm not saying she magically could have snapped out of it and realized, holy shit, what did I do? But she did attempt to dispose of him. You know, she did attempt to dispose of his body and everything. So she clearly knew that killing him was wrong because she dismembered him and was like basically telling the cops, oh crap, you know, I forgot his head. And she was using, like, trying to clean things up. So I think that's ultimately what made the jury believe that she wasn't having some kind of psychotic break. It took the jury a little under an hour to find her guilty of first-degree intentional homicide as well as sexual assault and dismemberment. The second phase of her trial began on July 27th, 2023. And this was for, I guess, them to decide if she was actually responsible for her actions. So she was guilty of doing it, but I don't know, this part of the trial was to see if she was responsible for her actions when she was doing them. The defense argued that she qualified for a not guilty by reason of insanity plea because of her diagnosis of a serious mental disorder. They claimed this disorder impacted her ability to know right from wrong, and she had also been on a lot of medications at the time and had not been properly taking them. And I will say, I don't like to get into too much detail about my own personal life, but I've experienced things in the past where I've taken medications that have literally made me completely not myself. They've made me feel not like myself. They've made me do things that, you know, normal me never would have done. Now, obviously, I didn't go out and kill people, but there was a point in time where I was on some medications that, yeah, I just wasn't myself and I needed to get off of them and I couldn't handle feeling not like me. So once again, I'm not giving her an excuse. I'm just saying I know how bad that affects a person, but she made the choices. And once again, what I think caught the jury was she knew right from wrong. They're claiming that she didn't know right from wrong because she had a mental disorder and she was taking medication and then she stopped taking them. But she knew right from wrong because she decided to try to clean up and dismember him and hide the, you know, body. Well, was going to hide it. So that made them believe like she did know her actions were wrong because of the cleanup. It was determined that at the time of the murder, she was of sound mind and that she should be sent to prison rather than a mental institution. It took the jury an hour to come to this decision as well. At her sentencing hearing on September 26th, she arrived to her trial half an hour late and wearing a spit hood. So it would seem that she may have been resisting being taken to trial or something of that nature. She was fighting, you know, the police trying to take her. They put a spit hood on her, I guess, to obviously protect the officers, but then to protect everyone else in court because they just weren't sure what she was going to do while she was there. She was already acting, you know, wild and everything when they were trying to bring her there. Family members testified on her behalf about what kind of traumas she had endured in her life. And we talked about this earlier. Well, I feel that a lot of people that do things such as this have endured trauma. And I can sympathize with that. I mean, sympathize with the fact that, yes, they've endured trauma. And, you know, a lot of people, they just don't deserve, you know, that kind of thing. But once again, not all of us that have endured trauma end up this way. So we don't go out, all of us don't go out killing and brutally dismembering corpses because we live rough lives. And I understand that all of us are different and we take things different, but there is just something majorly wrong with Taylor. And I do believe that she should never be out in society again because I don't believe that she can fully ever be helped. I mean, it would make probably more sense to most people to put her in a mental facility forever, you know, just to be able to assess her condition and even learn from her situation. And once again, I have put a lot more of my opinion into this episode, oddly enough, but I just kind of never understood why they lock some people away in prison and kind of throw away the key whenever they could put these people in psychiatric facilities and study them. They could seriously learn things from people like this. They can learn what happens to these people, what causes them to do such things, you know, what causes them to turn out this way versus somebody who has endured trauma like them, but never turned out that way. They could definitely just use people to study them. And I'm not saying you're obviously going to prevent killings in the future or prevent all killings, but hey, maybe they'll discover something that would prevent stuff like this from happening or prevent people from getting to this point. But now, obviously, if you don't get help with your mental disorders, mental illnesses, no one's going to know you have them. So you can't be helped, but you have to get help. So Shad's uncle stated that she had done one of the most cowardly, weakest things possible by gaining Shad's trust and fully taking advantage of his kindness in the most grotesque of ways. He said the family won't be able to recover from this and that he doesn't understand why Taylor should be given a chance of parole. Shad's father said he forgave her for what she's done and that she's the person who's going to have to live with the horrible consequences of making a bad choice and that hating her is not going to help him. And I fully sympathize with him. It's depressing to me, and I don't understand how somebody could forgive somebody for doing something this, you know, this heinous, this bad. Because me, as a person, I just have a hard time forgiving people for smaller things that really affect me, let alone, you know, killing my child or something of that nature. So he is a very strong man. Taylor was ultimately sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, and she received an extra 10 and a half years in prison and 8 years of extended supervision for the mutilation of a corpse and the sexual assault on a corpse. To kind of add a slight insult to injury, her husband Warren made a post on Facebook standing by her on February 25th of this year stating, quote, "My wife might be locked up for a long time, if not life, but what the world / community don't understand is my release date is soon. In either way, my prayers go out to my wife, Taylor Shabusiness. She needs help mentally. Brown County Jail and the Brown County Circuit Courts are failing at understanding this, nor do they even care. Yes, what she is being accused of is serious, but this doesn't change that she still has rights and she still has family and people that love her no matter what her situation might be. Hopefully soon the courts and jail will realize she needs help. People like to be nosy, I get that. People judge, I get that too. It's what this world does and will continue to do. Either way, I stand behind my wife and I will forever stand behind her. Forever. I know what she's being accused of is not who she is. Not only has her addiction played a big role, but so does her mental background, as well as postpartum depression. I just want my wife to get help, professional help, because it's what she deserves. Like I said, my prayers go out to my wife. I love her more than anything in this world, and this will never change no matter what." End quote. So I can understand his feelings, and I'm shocked that he did acknowledge that what she did was serious, but it kind of bothers me, because if he knew that she was struggling so badly and he knew what she was dealing with and he was afraid maybe she was going to do something bad or that her addiction was spiraling out of control, why did he not get her help? Why did he not attempt to help her? He was married to her. He says he loves her and all this. He loves her so much forever and blah, blah, blah. But why? Why did he not get her help? Why did he not care enough to get her help, get her off the drugs, get himself off the drugs? Instead, he ends up in prison because of dealing, you know, meth. If he loved her, he would have gotten her help. And I'm not saying that if she would have gotten help, she wouldn't have done this. But hey, she might have had a fighting chance at cleaning up her life a little bit. But it was ultimately her choice too, because he can't force her. And I just, these kind of cases make me really sad, you know, because maybe something could have been done if they would have just got help and realized that the road they were going down, both of them, was obviously not a good one. But to make it worse, though, his post on Facebook, he didn't even make any statement about the victim or at least mention how sorry he feels for the victim or the victim's family. He didn't say anything about the victim. He was just kind of bragging about, you know, loving his wife and everything and how she needed help. But for him to not even make any sort of little statement about, you know, the victim, that's just insane to me. I feel like I've blabbed enough in this episode, but this case is just something that I've been seeing a lot, and I was curious, and I'm glad I looked into it, because I just never imagined that it would be something like this. All right, everyone, that concludes this episode of It's Crime Time. Thank you for listening, and until next time.